With a grunt, Resser tumbled to the soft ground, and four men piled on top of him. Drunk and maddeningly sluggish, Duncan tried to throw off his attackers to help his comrade. But they struck him at the temples with the stun sticks, flooding his mind with blackness. When he came to consciousness, struggling with a sour gag in his mouth, Duncan saw a sea skimmer beached nearby on the dark shore. Farther out, with no running lights, the shadowy hulk of a much larger boat bobbed in the waves. His captors threw him unceremoniously aboard the skimmer. The limp form of He Resser tumbled beside him.
"Don't try to get free of those shigawire bindings unless you want to lose your arms," a deep voice growled in his ear. He felt the fiber biting into his skin.
Duncan ground his teeth, trying to chew through the gag. On the beach he saw pools of blood, weapons broken and discarded into the rising tide. The attackers carried the wrapped forms of 11 men, obviously dead, onto the narrow skimmer. So he and Resser had fought well, like true swordmasters. Perhaps they weren't the only captives. The shadowy men shoved Duncan into a crowded, stinking lower deck, where he bumped into other bound men on the floorboards, some of his comrades from class. In the darkness he saw fear and rage in their eyes. Many were bruised and beaten, the worst injuries patched with rag bandages. With only a faint groan, Resser awoke beside him. From the glint in his friend's eyes, Duncan knew the redhead had assessed the situation, too. Thinking alike, they rolled together at the bottom of the skimmer, back to back. With numb fingers, they worked carefully at each other's bonds, trying to break free. One of the shadowy men uttered a curse and kicked them apart. At the front of the skimmer, men spoke in low tones with heavy accents, Grumman accents. Resser continued to struggle against his bonds, and one of the men kicked him again. The motor started, a low purr, and the small craft got underway, heading out into the waves. Farther out at sea, the ominous dark boat waited for them. How easily grief becomes anger, and revenge gains arguments. Padishah Emperor Hasik III, Lament for Seleucia Secundus. In a dome-roofed chamber of his residency at Arakeen, Hasimir Fenring contemplated a difficult mind-teaser puzzle. A hollow representation of geometrical shapes, rods, cones, and spheres that fitted together and balanced perfectly. But only when all of the electropotentials were evenly spaced. During his youth, he had played similar games in the Imperial Court of Kaitane. Fenring usually won. In those years, he'd learned much about politics and conflicting powers, learning more, in fact, than Shaddam ever had. And the Crown Prince had realized it. "Hasimir, you're much more valuable to me away from the Imperial Court," Shaddam had said when sending him away. "I want you on Arrakis watching over those untrustworthy Harkonnens and making sure my spice revenues are untouched, at least until the damned Tleilaxu finish their Amal research." Rich yellow sunlight drizzled through the dome windows, distorted by house shields that diverted the day's heat while protecting the mansion against possible mob attacks. Fenring simply couldn't abide the high temperatures on Arrakis. For 18 years now, Fenring had built his power base in Arakeen. At the residency, he lived with all the comforts and pleasures he could wring from this dust bowl. He felt content enough in his position. He placed one shimmering puzzle stick above a tetrahedron, almost let go, then adjusted the piece to precisely the correct location. Willowbrook, the slack-jawed chief of his guard force, chose that moment to stride in and clear his throat, shattering Fenring's concentration.
"The water merchant Rondo Tuic has requested an audience with you, my lord count."
In disgust, the count switched off the pulsing puzzle before the separate pieces could tumble across the table.
"What does he want, Personal business, he called it. But he stressed that it is important.
Fenring tapped long fingers on the tabletop where the brain teaser puzzle had glowed moments before. The water merchant had never requested a private audience. Why would Tuwick come here now? He must want something.
Or he knows something.
Typically, the odd-looking merchant attended banquets and social functions. Knowing the true seat of power on Arrakis, he provided Fenring's household with extravagant amounts of water, more than the Harkonnen overlords received in Carthag.
Ah, he's aroused my curiosity. Send him in and see that we are not disturbed for 15 minutes.
The Count pursed his lips.
After that I'll decide whether or not I want you to take him away.
Moments later, the lumpy-shouldered Tuwick entered the domed chamber with a rolling gait, swinging his arms as he walked. He swiped a hand across his rusty gray hair, smoothing it into place with sweat, then bowed. The man looked flushed from ascending so many stairs. Fenring smiled, approving of Willowbrook's decision to make him climb rather than offering the private lift that would have brought him directly to this level.
Fenring remained at his table, but did not motion for the visitor to sit. The water merchant stood in his formal silver robe, wearing a gaudy necklace of dust-pitted platinum links around his throat. No doubt sandstorm-scoured in a rough attempt at Arrakis art.
"Do you have something for me?" Fenring inquired, flaring his nostrils. "Or do you wish something from me,
"I can provide you with a name, Count Fenring," Tuwick said without prettying his words. "As for what I wish in return," he shrugged his lumpy shoulders, "I expect you will pay me as you see fit."
"So long as our expectations are commensurate. What is this name, and why should I care?"
Tuwick leaned forward like a tree about to fall.
"It's a name you haven't heard in years. I suspect you'll find it interesting."
"I know the Emperor will."
Fenring waited, but not patiently. Finally, Tuwick continued.
"The man has kept a low profile on Arrakis, even as he does his best to disrupt your activities here. He wishes revenge on the entire Imperial House, though his original quarrel was with Elrood the Ninth."
"Oh, everyone had a quarrel with Elrood," Fenring said. "He was a hateful old vulture."
"Who is this man?"
"Dominic Vernius," Tuwick replied.
Fenring sat straight up, his bright, overlarge eyes widening further.
"The Earl of Ix? I thought he was dead."
"Your bounty hunters in Sardaukar never caught him. He has been hiding here on Arrakis with a few other smugglers. I do a little business with them now and then."
Fenring sniffed.
"You didn't inform me immediately? How long have you known?"
"My Lord Fenring," Tuwick said, sounding overly reasonable. "Elrood signed the vendetta papers against the Renegade House, and he's been dead for many years. As far as I could tell, Dominic seemed to be causing no harm. He'd already lost everything, and other problems demanded my attention."
The water merchant took a deep breath.
"Now, however, matters have changed. I feel it's my duty to inform you, because I know you have the Emperor's ear."
"And what exactly has changed,
In the back of Fenring's mind, wheels were turning. House Vernius had disappeared long ago. Lady Shando had been killed by Sardaukar hunters. Exiled on Caladan, the Vernius children were considered no threat. An angry and vengeful Dominic Vernius could cause damage, especially so close to the precious spice sands. Fenring had to ponder this.
"Earl Vernius requested a heavy transport. He seemed extremely disturbed, and may be planning a strike of some sort. In my opinion, this might mean an assassination plot against the Emperor. That was when I knew I had to come to you."
Fenring raised his eyebrows, wrinkling his forehead.
Because you thought I would pay you a greater reward than Dominic's bribes add up to?
Tuic spread his hands and responded with a deprecating smile, but did not deny the accusation. Fenring respected the man for that. Now, at least, everyone's motivations were clear. He ran a finger along his thin lips, still pondering.
Very well, Tuic. Tell me where to find the renegade Earl's hiding place. Explicit details, please. And before you depart, see my exchequer. Make a list of everything you require, every desire or reward you could imagine. And then I'll choose. I'll grant you whatever I believe your information was worth.
Tuic didn't quibble, but bowed.
Thank you, Count Fenring. I am pleased to be of service.
After providing the known details of the smuggler's Antarctic facility, Tuic backed toward the door just as Willowbrook re-entered, precisely at the end of 15 minutes.
Willowbrook, take my friend to our treasure rooms. He knows what to do, For the rest of the afternoon, leave me in peace. I have much thinking to occupy me.
After the men departed and the door to the chamber slid shut, Fenring paced, humming to himself, alternately smiling and frowning. Finally, he switched on his brain-teaser puzzle again. It would help him relax so that he could focus his thoughts. Fenring enjoyed plots within plots, spinning wheels concealed within wheels. Dominic Vernius was an intelligent adversary, and most resourceful. He had eluded Imperial detection for years, and Fenring thought it would be most satisfying to let the renegade Earl have a hand in his own destruction. Count Fenring would keep his eyes open, extending the spider web, but he would let Vernius make the next move. As soon as the renegade had everything in place for his own plans, then Fenring would strike. He would enjoy giving the outlaw nobleman just enough rope to hang himself. Paradise on my right, hell on my left, and the angel of death behind me. Freeman Conundrum. True to his word, the water merchant obtained an unmarked hauler for Dominic Vernius. Absent-minded Lingar Butte piloted it from Carthag to the Antarctic ice mining facility, and, with a sheepish smile, handed over the control card for the ship. Dominic, accompanied by his lieutenant Jodam, flew the battered craft back toward the secret landing field in the crevasse. The former Earl of Ix remained silent for most of the journey. The heavy hauler was old and made strange groaning sounds as it cruised low through the atmosphere. With a curse, Jodam slapped the control panels.
Damn slug! Probably won't function for more than a year, Dom. It's junk!
Dominic gave him a distant look. It'll be good enough, Jodam. Years ago, he'd been there when Jodam's face was burned by a backlash flame. Then the veteran had saved Dominic's life during the first abortive raid on Ix, hauling him from the line of Sardaukar fire. Jodam's loyalty would never flag. But now it was time for Dominic to set him free, to give the man back his life. When Jodam's skin flushed with anger, the burn scar tissue looked pale and waxy.
"Have you heard how many Solaris Tuic charged us for this wreckage? If we'd had equipment like this on Akaz, the rebels could have beaten us by throwing rocks."
They had broken Imperial law together for years, but Dominic had to do the rest alone. He felt oddly content with his decision and kept his voice even and calm. "Rondo Tuic knows we will no longer pay him our usual bribes. He wants to make as much profit as he can."
"But he's cheating you, Dom."
"Listen to me." He leaned close to his lieutenant in the adjacent seat. The heavy hauler vibrated as it came in for a landing. "It does not matter. Nothing matters. I just need enough to do what I must do.
Sweat glistened on Jodam's scarred face as the craft came to a stop at the bottom of the crevasse. The lieutenant moved with tight, jerky gestures as he stomped down the landing ramp. Dominic could see the uncertainty and helplessness in the man's face. He knew Jodam was not furious merely with what the water merchant had done, but also at what Dominic Vernius planned to do. Dominic longed to liberate Ix and his people, doing something positive to make up for all the wrongs that had been done by the Tlaloxu invaders and their Sardaukar allies. But he could not accomplish that, not now. In his power, he had only the capability for destruction. The former Ixian ambassador, Kamar Pilru, had made repeated pleas to the Landsraad, but by now the man had merely become a tiresome joke. Even Romber's efforts, probably made with secret Atreides support, had amounted to nothing. The problem had to be destroyed at its heart. Dominic Vernius, former Earl of Ix, would send a message that the entire Imperium would never forget. After making his decision, Dominic had taken his men deep into the fortress and opened the storage vault. Staring at the stored atomics, the smugglers froze. They had all dreaded this day. They'd served with the renegade Earl long enough that they needed no detailed explanations. The men stood inside the cold corridors, leaning against the polymer-lined walls. "I will go to Caladan first, then alone to Kaitain," Dominic had announced. "I have written a message for my children, and I mean to see them again. It has been far too long, and I must do this thing." He looked at each one of the smugglers in turn. "You men are free to do as you wish. I suggest you liquidate our stockpiles and abandon this base. Go back to Gurney Halleck on Seleucia, or just return to your families. Change your names, erase all records of what we did here. If I succeed, there will no longer be a reason for our band to exist." "And the whole Landsraad will be out for our blood," Jodam growled. Asuyo tried to talk Dominic out of it, using a military tone, an officer reasoning with his commander. But he would not listen. Earl Vernius had nothing to lose, and a great deal of vengeance to gain. Perhaps if he obliterated the last of the Carinos, his own ghost and Shando's could rest peacefully. "Load these weapons on board the cargo hauler," he said. "I will pilot it myself. A guild highliner arrives in 2 days." He gazed at them all, his expression flat and emotionless. Some of the men wore stricken looks, tears welled in their eyes. But they knew better than to argue with the man who had commanded them in countless battles, the man who had once run all the industries on Ix. Without friendly banter or conversation, the men took suspensor grapples and began to drag out the atomics, one load at a time. They did not move with haste, dreading the completion of their task. Without eating or drinking, Dominic observed the progress all day long. Metal-encased warheads were carried out on pallets and then guided through tunnels to the crevasse landing field. He daydreamed about seeing Romber and talking with him about leadership. He wanted to hear Kailia's aspirations. It would be so good to see them both again. He tried to imagine what his children looked like now, their faces, how tall they were. Did they have families of their own? His grandchildren? Had it really been more than 20 years since he'd seen his son and daughter? Since the fall of Ix? There would be some risk, but Dominic had to take the chance. They would want him to do it. Every precaution would be taken. He knew how difficult this would be emotionally, and he promised himself he would be strong. If Romber found out what he was up to, should he tell his son? The prince would want to join the effort and fight in the name of Ix. What would Kailia's reaction be? Would she try to talk her brother out of going? Probably. Dominic decided it would be best not to reveal his plans to his children, for that could only cause problems. Best to see his son and daughter without telling them anything. There might be one more child, too, whom Dominic wished he could locate. His beloved Shando had given birth to a son out of wedlock before marrying Dominic. The child, born secretly when she was a concubine in the Imperial Palace, had been Elrud Carino's, but had been taken away from her shortly after its birth. Shando had not been able to keep her son, and, despite her persistent requests for information, she never learned what had happened to him. He just disappeared. Unable to bear watching the preparations, Asuyo and Jodam worked at transferring the treasury reserve and supplies into the hands of the men. Old Asuyo had made a point of removing his medals and rank insignia, throwing them on the ground. Everyone would have to depart from the base at once and scatter to the far corners of the Imperium. Muttering to himself, Jodam inventoried the stockpile of spice they had collected, and with two other men, led an expedition back to the water merchant's industrial facility. There they intended to convert the remaining merchandise into liquid credit, which they would use to buy passage, identities, and homes for themselves. In his final hours, Dominic removed possessions from his quarters, giving away meaningless treasures, keeping only a few things he wanted at his side. The hollow portraits of Shando and keepsakes of his children meant more to him than any wealth. He would give them back to Romber and Kylea, so they had some memento of their parents. Smelling the cold brittleness inside what had been his home for so many years, Dominic noticed details he hadn't seen since building the fortress. He studied cracks in the wall, uneven lumps on the floor and ceiling. But he felt only failure and emptiness inside. He knew of only one way to fill that void. With blood. He would make the Carinos pay. Then his children and the people of Ix would be proud of him. When all but three hover warheads and a pair of stone burners had been moved aboard the heavy hauler, Dominic walked out into the wan Antarctic sunshine, a slice of light that carved into the deep fissure. He had planned every step of his attack on the Imperial capital. It would be a complete surprise. Shaddam wouldn't even have time to hide under the Golden Lion throne. Dominic would make no grandiose speeches, would not revel in his triumph. No one would know of his arrival. Until the end. Elrud IX was already dead, and the new Padishah Emperor had only a Bene Gesserit wife and four young daughters. It would not be difficult to exterminate the Carino bloodline. Dominic Vernius would sacrifice his life to destroy the imperial house that had ruled for thousands of years, since the Battle of Corrin. And he would call it a bargain. He drew a deep breath into his barrel chest. He turned his head, looking up the sheer canyon walls of the fissure, saw Jodam's shuttle land, returning from his errand at Tuix Water Factory. He didn't know how long he stood like a statue as his men moved around him, taking inventory of the atomic stockpile. A voice startled him out of his concentration. Jodam rushed red-faced toward him, his parka hood tossed back. "We've been betrayed, Dom. I went to the water merchant's facility, and it's abandoned. All the off-worlders have gone. The factory is closed down. They packed up and left in a hurry." Panting, Asuyo added, "They don't want to be around, sir, because something is going to happen." His entire demeanor had changed. Even without his medals, Asuyo looked like a military officer again, ready for a bloody engagement. Some of the smugglers cried out in rage. Dominic's expression turned stony and grim. He should have expected this. After all the years of cooperation and assistance, Rondo Tuic could still not be trusted. "Gather what you can. Go to Arsunt or Carthag or Arrakeen, but leave before the end of the day. Change your identities. Dominic gestured toward the old heavy hauler. I want to get the last warheads and take off. I still intend to go about my mission. My children are waiting for me. Less than an hour later, during the final preparations for evacuation and departure, the military ships arrived. An entire wing of Sardaukar in attack thopters, cruising low. They dropped concussion bombs that fractured the frozen walls. Wide lasergun beams flashed the cliffs into steam and dust, liberating the ice in the matrix and sending boulders tumbling down into melted craters. The Sardaukar vessels tilted their wings to dive like predatory fish into the chasm. They dropped more explosives, destroying four transport ships parked on the loose gravel. Determined, Asuyo rushed to their nearest thopter and leaped inside. He fired up the jet engines, as if already confident of receiving another medal for bravery. As he rocketed upward, the thopter's weapon turrets brightened. Asuyo spared a few breaths over the comm system to curse Tuik's treachery and the Sardaukar too. Before he could get off a shot, though, two Imperial ships blew him into a smudge of fire and greasy smoke in the sky. Troop carriers landed on the flat ground, and armed fighting men surged out like maddened insects, carrying hand weapons and knives. With precise accuracy, Sardaukar forces turned the engine pods of Dominic's loaded heavy hauler to slag. The family atomics, suspected by the Sardaukar to be aboard, were now stranded. The banished Earl could never take off, never reach Kaitain. And seeing the swarm of Imperial troops, Dominic knew that he and his smuggler band would never get away. Bellowing like a military commander again, Jodam led his final charge. The men ran recklessly, firing mismatched weapons into the oncoming Sardaukar troops. Using knives or bare hands, the Emperor's fighters slew every smuggler they encountered. To them, this activity was little more than practice, and they seemed to be doing it for the sheer enjoyment. Jodam retreated with his few surviving men back to the tunnels where they could barricade themselves and defend. In a frightening flash of deja vu from the Akazi rebellion, Dominic watched a Sardaukar laser blast take off Jodam's head, just like his brother's. Dominic had only one chance. It would not be the victory he had anticipated, and Romber and Kylia would never know about it. But given the alternative of total failure, he chose another desperate measure. He and his men were going to die anyway. For honor, he wanted to stay beside his troops, to fight to the death with each one of them, in what would ultimately be a futile gesture. They knew it, and so did he. The Sardaukar were representatives of the Emperor, giving Dominic Vernius the opportunity to strike a deadly symbolic blow. For Ix, for his children, for himself. As concentrated fire began to bring down the walls of the chasm in mounds of slumping mud and stone, Dominic ducked inside the base. Some of his men followed, trusting him to lead them to shelter. Silent and grim, he offered no reassurances. The Sardaukar penetrated the facility, advancing in attack formation through the passages, cutting down anyone they saw. They had no need to take captives for interrogation. Dominic retreated into the inner passageways, down toward the vault. It was a dead-end corridor. The frightened men behind him now understood what he meant to do. "We'll hold them as long as we can, Dom," one man promised. He and a partner took up positions on either side of the corridor, their meager weapons drawn and ready. "We'll give you enough time." Dominic paused for just a moment. "Thank you. I won't let you down." "You never have, sir. We all knew the risks when we joined you." He reached the open door to the armored storage chamber just as a loud explosion rang out behind him. The walls collapsed, breaking through the polymer sheath and sealing him and his men down there. But he had never intended to leave anyway. The Sardaukar would cut their way through the barrier within minutes, They had smelled the blood of Dominic Vernius and would not stop until they had him in their hands. He allowed himself a mirthless smile. Shaddam's men were in for a surprise. Dominic used the palm lock to seal the vault doors, even as he saw the collapsed barricade glowing with inner heat. Solid walls muffled the sounds behind him. Shielded by the heavy vault door, Dominic turned to look at the remaining items in his atomic stockpile. He chose one of the stone burners, a smaller weapon whose yield could be calibrated to destroy an entire planet, or just wreak havoc in a specified area. The Sardaukar began hammering on the thick door as he removed the stone burner from its case and studied the controls. He never thought he'd need to understand these weapons. They were meant as doomsday devices, never to be used, whose mere existence should have been a sufficient deterrent against overt aggression. Under the Great Convention, any use of atomics would bring down the combined military forces of the Landsraad to destroy the offending family. The men out in the corridor were already dead. Dominic had nothing left to lose. He tamped down the fuel consumption of the stone burner and set the activation mechanism to vaporize only the vicinity of the base. No need to wipe out all the innocents on Arrakis. That was the sort of thing only a Carino would do. He felt like an ancient sea captain going down with his ship. Dominic harbored only one regret, that he hadn't had a chance to say his farewells to Romber and Kylia after all, to tell them how much he loved them. They would have to carry on without him. Through a blur of tears, he thought he saw a shimmering image of Shando again, her ghost, or just his wishful desires. She moved her mouth, but he couldn't tell if she was scolding him for his recklessness or welcoming him to join her. The Sardaukar cut their way through the frozen wall itself, bypassing the thick door. As they entered the vault, smug and victorious, Dominic did not fire at them. He simply looked down at the scant remaining time on the stone burner. The Sardaukar saw it too. Then everything turned white hot. If God wishes thee to perish, he causes thy steps to lead thee to the place of thy demise. Cant of the Shariat. Of all the covert attempts Keter Pilru had made during 20 years as a guerrilla fighter on Ix, he had never dared to disguise himself as one of the Tleilaxu masters. Until now. Desperate and alone, he could think of nothing else to do. Mirala Lakem had vanished. The other rebels were dead, and he had lost all contact with his outside supporters, the smugglers, the transport officials willing to accept bribes. Young women continued to disappear, and the Tleilaxu operated with complete impunity. He hated them all. With cold calculation, Keter waited in a deserted corridor up in the office levels and killed the tallest robed master he could find. He preferred not to resort to murder to achieve his aims, but he did not shrink from it either. Some actions were necessary. Compared to the blood on the hands of the Tleilaxu, his heart and conscience remained clean. He stole the gnomish man's clothes and identity cards and prepared to discover the secret of the Bene Tleilax research pavilion. Why was Ix so important that the Emperor would send his Sardaukar here to support the invaders? Where had all the captive women been taken? It had to be more than simple politics, more than the petty revenge of Shaddam's father against Earl Vernius. The answer must lie within the high-security laboratory. Miral had long suspected an illegal biological project, one that operated with covert imperial support. Perhaps even something that went against the strictures of the Butlerian Jihad. Why else would the Carinos be willing to risk so much for so long? Why else had they invested so heavily here, while overall Ixian profits diminished? Determined to discover the answers, he donned the robes of the slain Tleilaxu master, shifting the folds and cinching the maroon sash to hide the dark stain of drying blood. Then he disposed of the body, dumping it into the reopened field-lined shafts to the molten core of the planet, where the garbage was supposed to go. In a secret storeroom, he applied chemicals to his face and hands to leach the remaining color from his already pale flesh, and smeared wrinkling substances on his face to give himself the gray-skinned, shriveled appearance of a Tleilaxu overlord. He wore thin-soled slippers to keep his height down, and hunched over a little. He wasn't a large man, and he was aided by the fact that the Tleilaxu were not the most observant of people. Kater needed to be most wary of the Sardaukar. He checked his records, memorizing the passwords and override commands he had hoarded for years. His identity cards and signal jammers should be sufficient to get him past any scrutiny, even there. Taking on a hauteur to complete his masquerade, he emerged from his hidden chamber into the expansive grotto. He strode to the front of a crowd and stepped aboard a linked transport. After slipping his card through the scanner port, he punched in the location for the sealed research pavilion. The private bubble closed around him and detached itself from the rest of the transport system. The vessel cruised in midair above the crisscrossed paths of surveillance pods. None of the trans-eyes turned toward him. The transport bubble recognized his right to travel to the laboratory complex. No alarms were raised. No one paid attention to him. Below, workers moved about in their labors, guarded by an increasing number of Sardaukar. They did not bother to look up at the vessels drifting across the enclosed grotto sky. One step at a time, Kater passed through successive guarded gates and security fields, and finally into the hive-like industrial mass. The windows were sealed, the corridors glowing with an orange-tinged light. The stuffy air was warm and humid, with a putrid undertone of rotting flesh and unpleasant human residue. Huddled in his disguise, he walked along, trying to conceal the fact he was lost and uncertain of his destination. Kater didn't know where the answers might lie, but he dared not hesitate or look confused. He didn't want anyone to take notice of him. Robed Tleilaxu moved from chamber to chamber, absorbed in their work. They pulled hoods over their ears and heads, so Kater did the same, glad for the added camouflage. He withdrew a sheaf of Redulian crystal reports written in a strange code that he could not decipher, and pretended to study them. He turned down corridors at random, changing course whenever he heard other people approaching. Several gnomish men marched past him, speaking to each other in heated voices in their private Tleilaxu language, gesturing with long-fingered hands. They paid no attention to Kater. He located biological laboratories, research facilities with plaz-chrome-plated tables and surgical scanners, visible through open doorways that seemed to be protected by special scanning devices that he didn't want to try to penetrate. Nothing, however, provided him with the answers he needed. Breathing hard and sweating with tension, he followed main corridors that led toward the heart of the research pavilion. Finally, Kater found a higher level, an open-windowed observation gallery. The corridor behind him was empty. The air smelled metallic with chemicals and disinfectants, a scrubbed, sterile environment, and a faint but distinct odor reminiscent of cinnamon. He peered through the broad window into the huge central gallery of the laboratory complex. The vast chamber was large enough to be a spacecraft hangar, holding tables and coffin-sized containers, row upon row of specimens. He stared in horror at the pipes and sample tubes, at all the bodies, all the women. Even knowing how vile the Tleilaxu were, never before had he imagined such a nightmarish reality. The shock dried his unshed tears to a stinging acid. His mouth opened and closed, but he could form no words. He wanted to vomit. In the gigantic complex below, he saw at last what the Tleilaxu criminals were actually doing to the women of Ix. And one of them, barely recognizable, was Miral Alekum. Staggering with revulsion, he tore himself away. He had to escape. The sheer weight of what he'd seen threatened to crush him. It was impossible, impossible, impossible! His stomach knotted, threatening to double him over. Yet he dared not show any weakness. Unexpectedly, a guard and two Tleilaxu researchers rounded the corner and came toward him. One of the researchers said something in an unrecognizable guttural language. Keter didn't respond. He staggered away. Alarmed, the guard shouted after him. Keter stumbled down a side corridor. He heard an outcry, and his need for survival burned away his stunned malaise. After penetrating this far, he had to get out. No other outsider suspected what he had now seen with his own eyes. The truth was far worse than anything he could have imagined. Bewildered and desperate, Keter worked his way back to the lower levels, aiming for the external security grids. Behind him, guards rushed toward the observation galleries he had just left behind. But the Tleilaxu had not yet sounded an all-out alarm. Perhaps they didn't want to disrupt their daily routine. Or maybe they simply couldn't believe that one of the foolish Ixian slaves had managed to penetrate their tightest security. The research pavilion wing he had destroyed with wafer bombs 3 years ago had been entirely rebuilt. But the self-guiding supply rail had been moved to a different portal. He raced over there, hoping to slip through lighter security. Summoning a transport bubble, he climbed inside, using his stolen identity card and brusquely dismissing one of the guards who tried to question him. Then Keter drifted away from the security installation toward the nearest work complex, where he could chuck his disguise and melt in among the other laborers again. Before long, he heard a strident alarm raised behind him. But by now he had escaped the compound and the Tleilaxu secret police. He alone carried a hint of what the invaders were actually doing, why they had come to Ix. The knowledge did not comfort him, though. Now he felt a despair deeper than any he had experienced since beginning his fight. Treachery and quick thinking will defeat hard and fast rules any day. Why should we be afraid to seize the opportunities we see? Viscount Hundro Moritani, response to Lansrad court summons. On the heaving deck of the unmarked boat, a wild-eyed giant gazed down on his captives.
"Look at the would-be swordmasters!"
He laughed hard enough that they could smell his reeking breath.
"Weaklings and cowards, pampered by rules! Against a few stun sticks and a squad of half-trained soldiers, what good are you?"
Duncan stood on deck next to He'i Resser and four other Ginaz students, nursing cuts and bruises, not to mention skull-splitting hangovers. They had been released from their shigawire bindings, but a squad of heavily armed soldiers in yellow Mauritani livery waited nearby, holding an assortment of weapons. Overhead, the knotted gray sky brought darkness a full hour before its time.